That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are things that we take for granted in our contemporary lives. Clean water, flushing toilets, streetlights, cars, fresh food, knowing the time. Things so basic to how we function that we don't even consider their origins. Stephen Johnson does. His perspective on history is not about wars and great men. Instead, he looks at the hobbyists, the obsessive tinkerers, the garage mechanics, and sometimes college dropouts. People whose ideas set off a series of events, inventions, and outcomes that brought us to how we live today. Stephen Johnson is author of several best-selling books on innovation. Most recently, How We Got to Now, six innovations that made the modern world, and he's host of the PBS series of the same name. It's now available for viewing online in its entirety. And Stephen Johnson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
That's nice to be here.
So you didn't choose the steam engine or nuclear fission or the assembly line, but time, glass, cold, sound, clean, and light. Tell me about these decisions.
I'm glad you named them all because I often blank on one or two of them when I'm actually asked to name them myself, so that's good.
It's like the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I forgot Sleepy. One of the things that I wanted to do, or we wanted to do with the show, is to not focus on innovations that seem very high tech, right? We talk about innovation all the time in our society, but it's always about the latest gadget and, you know, the latest smartphone app and things like that. And so what I was interested in is things that have become so integrated into our lives that we no longer think of them as innovations in themselves, like glass, for instance.
Well, let's start with one of those most profound notions and the most far-reaching, time, which our concept of which has changed dramatically over the past 150 years when agrarian concepts of time were replaced by clocks, or more importantly, the pocket watch. These are the efforts of a man who was called the Lunatic of Boston in his time. Who was he? What was his story?
A surprising number of people in the book were called the Lunatic of Boston.
Yeah, Boston like figures
Boston
primarily.
Have this, it simultaneously generates interesting thinkers, but they are ridiculed by their peers. So it's this guy, Denison, who came up with this idea for basically kind of mass producing a watch. So up until around 1850, 1860, pocket watches were in circulation, but they were extremely expensive. And this guy, Denison, came up with this system basically modeled after the, kind of industrial production lines that were starting to appear for manufacturing things like guns. And he built this watch. It was called the Ellery watch. And it was really the first kind of breakthrough watch. It cost about a tenth of what other pocket watches cost at the time. And, it was kind of the kind of first draft of what then would become the, you know, the kind of Sony Walkman and the iPod more than 100 years later.
And it was also called the soldier's watch because so many soldiers had them during the Civil War. One of the results is that punctuality over a couple of decades becomes a social virtue, which was problematic at a time when hundreds of towns across the country had their own time, as did the 50 railroads operating in the U.S. That's what we learn from your book. How was this fixed?
Yeah, I love this is one of my favorite things because this is a classic example of this. We never think of coordinating time as an innovation, right? But as you said, in the United States, until around 1880, every single town was basically on its own time zone. So you would do a local reading of the sun. The point at which the sun was the highest in the sky was noon. And that meant that, you know, as you went from town to town, it would be 2 minutes ahead or 5 minutes behind the last town. And the key thing about this is that nobody even noticed that this was a problem. It genuinely wasn't a problem for an extremely long period of time because nobody needed to coordinate schedules between towns with that level of accuracy. It didn't matter if you lost a minute or two going from town to town because it took you an hour and a half on your horse to get from one town to the other. And then a new technology came along that exposed this problem or made it a problem in the first place, which was the railroad. The railroad suddenly meant that people were traveling from town to town in very kind of meticulously choreographed time schedules. And suddenly it was just incredibly hard to figure out what time it was. And so someone needed to solve this. And they'd kind of come up with the idea of standardizing time in Canada and in the UK. But in the US, it took quite a while. It was this guy named William Allen, who was a kind of railway clerk, basically, who got obsessed with this idea of building a time zone system. It was amazingly controversial. So all these during the period, this period, there are all these kind of angry letters to the editor written by people in towns across the country that are saying, Cincinnati will never adopt this artificial devil's time. You know, time is meant to be set by the sun as God intended it. But eventually people came around and actually the original time zone system that lasted for about 30 or 40 years, the edges of each division that now basically run along the edges of the states. Originally in Allen's map, it was defined by the railroad termination points, not by the states, which shows you how important the rail system was to our sense of time in the late 19th century.
William Allen triggers this kind of chain of events, right? And this happens often in this book, in this series. One person trying to solve a problem, getting something stuck in their craw. One such man I think of, Edward Leon Scott de Martinville. He's a
nice pronunciation.
Well, you know, I did my best. A French bookseller, essential in recording sound. Now, tell us more about him and his innovation.
So he invented a brilliant machine. It was called the phonautograph for recording audio, for capturing sound waves out of the air in the early 1850s, which is more than 20 years before Edison invents the phonograph. But the reason we've never heard of him is that he failed to include one key feature, which was playback. There was no way to listen to the audio that had been recorded. You could just record these little sound waves, but there was no way to actually hear what you'd recorded. And it wasn't like he was trying to add this feature and couldn't figure out how to do it. It never even occurred to him. He was just, as I said, it was kind of in his blind spot. Basically, his technology didn't take off, and he more or less died penniless. But two things happened. First off, a number of years later, another inventor was tinkering with Scott's device, and that inventor was Alexander Graham Bell inventing the telephone. So the phonautograph failed on its own, but it contained the seeds of this other technology that would take off. And the other cool thing about this story is that a group of audio historians, they got together a couple years ago and they found Scott's recordings and they scanned them into a computer and got the computer to play them back. And initially they thought they were hearing a little girl singing, but then they realized they were playing it too fast and they slowed it down and realized it was Scott himself. Half a century later, he finally got playback added to his phonautograph.
Well, and there's just a wonderful moment in the PBS series when you play that audio. Let's just hear a little bit of it. We're talking with Stephen Johnson about some of the innovations that were so big that we don't even think about them. He is the host of the new PBS series, How We Got to Now, 6 Innovations That Made the Modern World, and a book of the same name. Stephen Johnson, are these innovations really the result of the lone inventor? I mean, if Edward Leon Scott had not invented the phonoautograph, would it have just been somebody else?
You know, it's a great question. I spent a lot of time trying to get this right. It's a tricky thing, particularly thinking about the format that I was working with, because I was developing this as a show on PBS and then as a book. And in a funny way, television kind of wants you to have a hero.
You want
to have the person you can see. But a lot of the message of this project is that, you know, that invention is much more of a collective, collaborative network kind of affair, and that the single inventor is actually very unusual. In fact, there's a whole segment in both projects where we talk about Edison and how every school kid learns that Edison invented the light bulb. And in fact, Edison didn't invent the light bulb. Mm-hmm. There were 20 people who were working on the light bulb in various forms, almost all of whom hit upon most of the key ingredients that Edison hit upon. And Edison was aware of those people and building on their ideas. And as you kind of implied, there's an inevitability to that invention. Someone was going to invent the air conditioner by the, you know, kind of first years of the 20th century. It happened to be this guy, Willis Carrier, but there were other people working on it. And, you know, it was going to be invented by someone. It was just, in a sense, in the air.
With all of these positive changes, of course, you know, there is a less glowing side to some of them, especially for our Paleolithic era human bodies, you know. How have these innovations changed the way that we eat, live, sleep? What were the implications as far as you found in those areas?
Yeah, well, our bodies are not as evolving as quickly as the technology, mm-hmm. as our culture is, basically. And so occasionally you get this kind of lag. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that until artificial light came along in kind of the abundance of the late 19th century, where you had kind of gas lamps and then the electric light bulb in kind of the 1890s and at the turn of the century. Up until that point, in particularly in the winter, people basically would have what they call two sleeps. So they would go to bed, and as soon as it got dark, which, you know, in the Northeast could be, you know, 5 or 5:30 or something like that. And so they go to bed at 6 because there was nothing to do, basically. There wasn't enough light to kind of make it worthwhile to stay up. You had a couple of candles, and it was expensive to have those candles burning and so on. So people would go to sleep, but they didn't want to sleep for 14 hours. And so they would wake up in the middle of the night and be up for an hour or two and have a snack, you know, hang out, maybe light a candle and read a little bit, or, you know, procreate or, you know, use the facilities, whatever. Here, I'm trying to be gentle about this. And then they would go back to sleep and they would have a second sleep. And then all of a sudden artificial light came around, and suddenly after dark, your home, just your home alone or the outside world, was filled with all these things that you could do, you know. And you were like, well, I'm going to stay up and read initially, or I'm going to go out to a restaurant, or I'm going to go out and see a movie, or now I've got television and radio and I'm going to stay up and do that. And so we pushed back our bedtimes. And the argument is that when some of us suffer from insomnia, where we wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, it's really that kind of the echo of this natural rhythm of sleep that we'd had for presumably thousands and thousands of years, mm-hmm. that has been artificially interrupted by this light cycle of the electric light bulb.
And in that conversation about light, you point out that the use of whale oil light made it possible for people like Jane Austen and Herman Melville and Emily Dickinson to stay up and write at night. I mean, just one of these things we would never think of. Do you have a sort of like craziest revelation of triggered actions during this series for you?
Well, I think actually the whale oil that powered, you know, kind of artificial light in that period of spermaceti oil from the skull of the sperm whale. And it was basically the cleanest and purest and kind of whitest light you could find. It was the state of the art in kind of lighting technology from about 1730, 1740 until around 1840 or so. And this is one of these places actually where there's a really interesting kind of disjunction, it would seem, from the state of the art in other technologies. So to extract this whale oil, they would first capture a sperm whale and kill the whale, which is incredibly hard to do. But then they would have the whale up on the deck and they would cut a hole in the whale's skull. And the youngest boy on ship, who could be like 12 or 13 years old, would then crawl into the skull of the whale and extract this whale oil with a bucket. And so this is in an age when, you know, people were inventing the railroad and the telegraph and all these advanced, you know, technologies, and the steam engine, you know, is rewriting the kind of history of the world at that point. But simultaneously with all of that, the most advanced form of artificial lighting involved a 13-year-old crawling around in a whale skull.
Who'd been dead probably for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems wrong that, that those two things would be happening at the same time. But sometimes you get advances in one field that kind of jump ahead and the other field kind of lags behind.
There are a lot of big questions that are circulating, of course, in our culture now about whether, you know, we're so scattered or stressed out by always being accessible, being always on using our smartphones, for example. These innovations have changed the way we work, the way we live. And with your long Zoom of history, are we going to work these kind of questions out?
Well, I think, we're better at projecting forward, I think, and thinking about the unintended consequences. It's very hard to do that. I mean, I've spent a lot of time looking at innovation, but every time anybody asks me to, like, you know, wear my futurist hat and describe, you know, what life is going to be like in 20 or 30 years, I always kind of politely decline because I'm like, if you look back at this book, you know, and one of the big lessons is that, you know, you invent one thing and it ends up triggering all these changes that you would have never anticipated in advance. And that's going to keep happening. But I think we're a little bit better. I think there's a lot more, for instance, writing about technology today that is thinking about the cultural impact of these new tools and not just, you know, kind of reviewing them as products. You know, I remember when I first started writing about technology, if you looked at people writing about computers, it was just, you know, it was just product reviews. You know, mm-hmm. It was like, oh, there's a new Mac and I give it 4 stars. And the idea that these machines were going to ripple out through society and change the way we listen to music and change the business models of all these creative industries and affect the way we communicate with our friends and the way that families form and national border, all these, you know, issues now that we kind of take it for granted that technology is going to shape our lives in this way, I don't think that was as much a part of the conversation 25 years ago, say. And so I think we don't have any easy answers to this, but we were at least, you know, asking the right questions now.
Well, Stephen Johnson, just fascinating. It just triggers so many questions, and I appreciate your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Enjoyed it a lot.
Stephen Johnson, his most recent book is also a PBS series called How We Got to Now, 6 Innovations That Made the Modern World. There are links to find more, including video trailers from the series at wordofmouthradio.org. Ferguson, Missouri is bracing for a grand jury verdict in the shooting of Michael Brown due sometime this month, again sparking conversations about race and racism in communities across the country. Up next on Word of Mouth, a filmmaker asks whether a fruitful discussion can really happen if the privileged majority can't name what it means to be white. Stay with us as we learn about the Whiteness Project. That's coming up after the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What does it mean to be white? That question is rarely asked in any kind of direct way in America. Filmmaker Whitney Dow has found that white people don't feel comfortable talking about whiteness, which he thinks is an essential part of our national conversation about racial identity, culture, and privilege. So Dow has set out to ask 1,000 white people that very question. What does it mean to be white? Even if the answers might be uncomfortable.
Do I think it's beneficial for me to be white? Have I gotten any privileges like that? I would say no.
I don't really think I've ever come across anything that has made me aware of my race.
I do not feel a specific common bond with white people. If you were going to ask me, do I feel a common bond with Jewish people, then the answer would absolutely be yes.
I don't know any people that aren't proud of, that they're white, you know, not in my social group.
Those are excerpts from the first installment of The Whiteness Project. It's a multimedia project from POV. At first blush, defining whiteness sounds like thinly veiled white supremacist propaganda. But dig a little deeper, and you'll find that creator Whitney Dow has a long track record for tackling race in complex ways. He and his African-American producing partner Marco Williams, for example, documented the aftermath of a modern-day lynching for the Peabody Award-winning documentary Two Towns of Jasper. To get candid reactions with the townspeople of Jasper, they deliberately segregated their film crew into black and white. Dow's the sort of filmmaker accustomed to sparking controversy and discussion, which is certainly the case for The Whiteness Project. And Whitney Dow, happy to speak with you on Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So what made you want to do a project like this? Pretty volatile, potentially.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I'm glad that you brought up Two Towns of Jasper, my work with Marco, because it's actually the DNA for this project is came out of Jasper and the work I've been doing with Marco over the last 18 years, is that I found that as we were doing projects, they tended to be oppositional constructs, meaning, you know, something where white people were doing something horrible to non-white people or something historical that had happened that was bad. And it kind of I felt it did two things. One, it kind of took everyday white people who weren't out, you know, doing horrible things off the hook because it allowed them to think that race and racism was something outside of themselves. Mm-hmm. When you're having a conversation across race, you're talking about commonalities and you're not really examining yourself. And I really felt like after a while that if I was interested in changing the dynamic of the race dynamic in this country, I had to look at my own community and understand my own race in order to have a productive conversation.
Well, you plan to do 1,000 interviews. So far, you've posted 21 from Buffalo, New York. Some very thought-provoking answers. Others, I have to say, kind of cringeworthy, but all seemingly very candid. So here, we're going to play another clip from one of the interviews this is conducted for The Whiteness Project.
There is one black man of prominence in the department, of a department of, I'd say, 50 or so people closely that I work close to. And so I think, okay, well, do I just roll in a line of work that attracts white guys, primarily like myself? Or is there something going on that they won't hire people of color? I don't know. It really it troubles me. And then I think, well, okay, I am social. I go out. I go downtown. I play games with friends. I'm very socially active. Why do I not hang around with or see, or why am I only primarily around white people?
So this man seems to be asking himself, am I subconsciously racist? I mean, was this a common viewpoint from people that you spoke to?
You know, I loved that interview with Rob, and I thought it was really interesting because he kind of reflects, I think, the viewpoint of a lot of people, people like myself. I mean, I have a very diverse professional life. You know, sometimes I'm the only, like, straight white male in the office. But when I look at my personal circle, my personal life, it is very monochromatic, and it is troubling to me, and I asked why that is. And I think that that's something that people who view themselves as open-minded and view themselves as progressive and view themselves as just are struggling with. How come, if this is the case, how come in our private spaces we tend still to be so segregated?
We do hear and learn from the Whiteness Project a number of statistics. One saying 75% of white people say that their social networks are predominantly white. Let's see, 72% of people identify as white alone. So, you know, like not French American or Italian or Polish, just white. These are people who we get the picture are not used to talking about race. So how did you first get people to agree to speak and get them to speak so openly on a subject that a lot of people avoid?
The way I run the interviews are pretty straightforward. I tell people we're going to be talking about race. If you don't like this, the interview, anything you've said, don't sign the release till after we're done. And so I'm pretty open with people about what I'm up to. But I also think that people are really interested in having this discussion. And I think white people are really interested in having this discussion. And you say they don't talk about race. I disagree. White people talk about race all the time. They just don't talk about their own race. Mm-hmm. And I think they're often in the conversation as talking about race as something other than themselves. But they do get uncomfortable. And I think that a lot of times when you say it's cringeworthy is that white people aren't used to talking about their race as a dynamic force in their lives. And so they do say some things that as they're sort of finding their way through the subject matter, they are going to say some things that perhaps don't sound so considered.
Hmm. Well, let's hear another clip from The Whiteness Project.
I think that, you know, with civil rights and everything, I think a lot of times that other minorities sometimes get more benefits than I would as being a white person. for some reason, some black people kind of hold on to the back in the day, the slave thing, or they feel they're not being treated right. Should slavery be something that, because it happened, we owe black people something more? Absolutely not. Like I said, it had nothing to do with me. It had nothing to do with black people living today.
Okay, so I'm going to call that a little cringy worthy. You know, for some reason, black people are upset about this whole slavery thing.
Well, again, what I say is that when people aren't used to talking about it, they do perhaps not know how to put things the best way. But I think that what Jason says there is something that a lot of white people are grappling with, despite in the terms that he puts it, is that do we owe black people something as white Americans? Everybody will agree that the history of American institutionalized racism and that, you know, that sort of not only was this country built on, but then was, you know, exist in this country for so long. And so what are our obligations, if any? And that's, you know, I think the data point after that is I think it's that one says 3% of white Americans think we should give reparations. Mm-hmm. So it is something that people are thinking about and grappling with. And even though it sounds – if 3% think we owe black people something, what he's saying is not something that is not a widely held thought. These are things that I've heard from people in, you know, the almost 20 years I've been doing this. And I really wanted to have things that people said be representational of things that were out there. And the data points are really to show, look, this isn't just Whitney's opinion. This is the reality. If you go to the census and you do any sort of like modicum of a search on it, all this information is out there. The other thing that I think is really interesting is the relationship between the quantitative and the qualitative. And what I mean by that is that the qualitative emotional experience of someone like Jason living in the world and the actual quantitative reality, as shown in some of the data points, of what the benefits are of being white in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand the desire to surface these things. And it's, you know, it obviously started a really interesting conversation just looking at some of the comments on the Whiteness Project. But do you worry at all that somebody might come to your website, listen for the first time, and write the whole thing off as a kind of form of racism or even PC racism?
Yeah, and absolutely, and I think that's happened on both fronts. And I get a lot of email about this project, and you know, I think that early on, before people really spent time with it, there was sort of this immediate reaction against it, sort of this visceral reaction against it. But I think that once people spent time with it, and as you said at the beginning, A, it had POV's name on it, and POV and Marco and I have a long relationship. We did, you know, Two Towns of Jasper with them. And then they looked at my track record of what I've been doing, and they said, well, this is something we have to consider. And what I've been interesting is that as the site's been up, people have been spending longer and longer and longer on it. So when it first came up, people were looking at it, doing a couple of things, having a reaction and mm-hmm. leaving. Mm-hmm. And now people are, I think they're spending like an average of 7 or 8 minutes on it, which is for a website is, you know, that means they're watching 7 or 8 of these videos is phenomenal. You know, I think part of having this conversation is being open to other people's point of view and being, you know, generous in how you're listening. And if somebody doesn't want to listen to what I have to say, I can't control that.
Let's hear another clip from one of the women that you interviewed for The Whiteness Project.
If you sit around with anyone, you know, they talk about how they're Italian or Polish or French or German, and it's a great source of pride. Very rarely have I ever heard anyone say, I'm white. Like, I think I would be thrown if I got that as an answer. I'd be like, yeah, that's great. And what else are you? In my mind, it's really just that box. It's checking that box on the government form because literally that's the only time I consider myself that. After that, it's strictly I think of myself in an ethnic way.
That was one of several clips of an interview conducted by the Whiteness Project. It's a multimedia documentary by filmmaker Whitney Dow, who's with us now, which asks white people to share their views on what it means to be white. And she is raising a really interesting notion, you know, this kind of idea of whiteness as a kind of lack of identity. You know, I think so often in American society, people define culture or ethnicity as other than white. What's going on here?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And that's one of the real motivations, the origin story of this project is me having experience where despite all my work on race with Marco, despite the films I had made, I hadn't really understood my race as sort of this active, dynamic component of my life. And that she says, when she says, you know, it's the only time I ever think of myself that way. But you know what? That's not that, you know, you have to understand that other people perceive you that way. You may not think of yourself that way. And I used to think, oh, well, you know, my whiteness is secondary to my individuality. And I've had a lot of experiences doing the work I've done where that's just been shown I've completely false, where that my identity as a white male is such a powerful sort of antecedent to people interacting with me that it actually supersedes my individual personality, my individuality. And I think that's a very scary thing for, I think, white Americans who haven't had to think about their race as this sort of force in their lives.
These interviews were conducted in Buffalo in July anyway, before Ferguson, Missouri blew up over the killing of an unarmed black man. Now, a lot of conversations followed that, saying, you know, we've got to talk about race in America. And this project, of course, preceded that. Is the Whiteness Project stirring a multiracial conversation, do you think, or is it being viewed primarily by a white audience?
I think it's a multiracial, and I have to be honest, I didn't set out to make a multiracial conversation. I kind of had this attitude, look, if white people are going to participate in this, they have to deal with some of their own stuff first. But what's been interesting is the feedback I've gotten from people of color from, you know, all across the political spectrum, saying how interesting and cathartic it was to see white people grapple with race. And also, one of the things I'm sure you notice when you watch it is that when people are asked about whiteness, white people asked about whiteness, they tend to talk about black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
it's always defining as not black.
Right. But I also have heard from, you know, a number of African-American people seen it that, you know, it's kind of parallels their experience where they feel that their blackness is defined by the whiteness of America. And it's interesting for them to see whites kind of grapple with the same thing.
So as you go across the country, do you think that the tenor of the conversation will change?
I think that it absolutely will. That if I go to, you know, the rural South, or I go to, you know, parts of the country that are very diverse, or parts of the country that aren't very diverse, places like Iowa, you're going to get very different types of reactions. But I also believe there will be some constants, and I think this constant of white people grappling with their whiteness is something that will be a constant throughout all the interviews.
Whitney Dow, thank you.
Thank you.
Whitney Dow is one of the filmmakers behind the Peabody Award-winning film Two Towns of Jasper. He is currently at work on The Whiteness Project. It's a multimedia documentary that explores the meaning of whiteness in America. And you can watch these tightly edited interviews from the project. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're anxious to know what you think. Does the whole concept of whites talking about whiteness strike you as indulgent? Does it rub you the wrong way? Or do you think, as awkward as it may be, it is an essential part of understanding race in America? Would you feel comfortable talking openly about your own race? Or do you think we're better off discussing commonalities rather than the differences? To make this a bigger conversation, we need to hear from you. So please share your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Over the past few years, the Washington Redskins have been embroiled in a series of battles over its team's name. Many object to the name for evoking the abject racism of a bygone era. But before engaging in the debate, it may help to understand the origins of the word redskin and how it came to be seen as offensive. As Lauren Ober reports, the word's genesis might come as a surprise.
This is an origin story in three parts. Part one, the word.
The word itself is a Native American tradition.
That's Ives Goddard, a senior linguist at the National Museum of Natural History here in the district. In 2005, he wrote an exhaustive paper charting the etymology of the word redskin.
Its emergence and use in Indian languages and in English has to be understood within the historical context.
That context, he says, was this. Before Europeans arrived on the new continent, Native people had no word for their race. You were Apache or Ojibwe, Salish or Seneca. There was no need for any self-designation beyond that. Then the Europeans landed. Native people needed a way to differentiate the two groups, and color designation seemed like the easiest shorthand.
The use of red for Indians appears in 1725 in two different places, in a French source and an English source, in talks between Indian chiefs and colonial officials. And it's what the Indians use.
Goddard should know. He's been studying Native American languages his entire professional life. He speaks lots of them, and when he heard claims in the early 1990s that the word redskin was derived from the practice of scalping Indians for a bounty, he balked. A manuscript written in 1815 by Meskwaki chief Black Thunder in his own language backed Goddard up.
A word, Meshkinomashkat, means redskin. And in fact, in the same sentence, Mapeshkinomashkat, which means white skin, which is a word that's still used today. The word that's literally white skin in Meskwaki is still the word for European.
Still, Goddard accepts that while the word redskin has native origins, the way we view words and the way we appropriate and reinterpret them can change over time.
Ethnic labels can rise and fall in acceptability and so forth. We all know famous examples. Some words you can't even say on the air anymore, which 100 years ago was just kind of normal for many people.
One of those ethnic labels ended up becoming a big part of Washington's cultural landscape. And that brings us to part two of our story, the team.
The organization started in 1932 in Boston. They were known as the Boston Braves, their very first season of existence.
Mike Richman is the author of the Redskins Encyclopedia. He bills himself as the premier historian of the team.
They had been founded by a man named George Preston Marshall. And then the following year, they became the Redskins, Boston Redskins, and stayed in Boston for a total of five seasons and then moved to Washington in 1937.
Back in the day, it was common for professional baseball and football teams from the same city to have the same or at least similar names. In 1933, Boston's football team began playing in Fenway Park, home to the Boston Red Sox. George Marshall decided the team name should reflect the move.
He kept red from Red Sox, and he also wanted to keep that Native American theme.
So Marshall went with the name Redskins. Legend also has it that Marshall wanted to honor the team's coach at the time, Lone Star Dietz, who claimed to be Sioux. Plus, the team had some Native players, so in Marshall's mind, the name made sense.
Marshall was a visionary, and my sense is when he saw the opportunity to capitalize on that Native American connection, he went for it.
As such, in the early days, the team's coach wore a headdress on the sidelines, and its players covered their faces in war paint. George Marshall also installed a marching band that played the team's fight song, Hail to the Redskins.
Back then, it was acceptable. And in none of my research that I've done have I ever come across anything that said he tried to exploit Native Americans.
Richman may not feel the Redskins' name is exploitative, but that's far from a universal belief. Which leads us to part three of this story, the controversy.
The first objections really date from the late 50s and early 60s. And they're only incidentally focused on sports.
So says J. Gordon Hilton, a visiting professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. In 2010, he wrote a Law Review article about the use of Native American team names.
The sort of initial wave of complaints is about the disparaging way in which Native Americans are portrayed in Hollywood films.
The representation of Native Americans as savage marauders pillaging wagon trains on the plains didn't sit well. But it wasn't until the 1980s that people began to make noise about Native team names.
Once people began to complain about the depiction of Plains Indians, that this is unfair and this is racist and it's highly prejudicial, then I think that also adds to the sort of pejorative character.
For a long time, Native Americans have been seen as a public domain symbol for Anglo-Americans, not unlike, say, the bald eagle. But many Native people, like Suzanne Schoen Harjo, a Cheyenne and Muscogee activist, didn't appreciate being an abstract motif in American popular culture. In 1992, Harjo and seven other Native plaintiffs filed a complaint with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office against the Redskins, claiming that the team name was disparaging and should be deregistered.
This would not keep the Redskins from using the name, but it would deny them the kind of economic advantages of having a protected trademark.
That case fizzled on a technicality, but a new case is now being heard by the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. Harjo spoke about the issue with WAMU last year.
They can call themselves any old racist thing they want. The issue before the court is whether the federal government should subsidize with the exclusive right of making money that racism, and we think not.
As the debate over the team's name continues, the controversy has raised some critical issues. Who owns language, and who has the right to use it? And at what point can language be considered cultural property? There are no easy answers. But knowing the origins of the word in question is a first step. I'm Lauren Ober.
Stick around for more Word of Mouth. When we return, a look at a biomarker that may reveal much more about a crime scene than fingerprint or DNA evidence. What a perp's microbiome reveals after they leave the room. That's coming up after a break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The fingerprint used to be law enforcement's smoking gun. Find one on a murder weapon and you've got your suspect. Next came DNA evidence, forensic technology that has since put thousands behind bars and in some cases freed inmates wrongfully convicted. Now researchers are studying another biomarker that may be able to tell us even more about a crime scene, bacterial signatures. Jack Gilbert is an environmental microbiologist and team leader at Argonne National Laboratory and lead author of a paper exploring microbiomes in our homes and apartments. Jack, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
The reason fingerprints and DNA have been so useful for law enforcement is they're unique to whoever leaves them. How unique is a person's bacterial signature?
Your bacterial signature is 100% unique to you. Even genetically identical twins have very different microbial signatures in their body. And that's because we all experience different interactions with the world from the moment we're born until the moment we get to the current state where we are. So your microbial diversity is shaped by those interactions. And so we none of us live the same life as another person. So we develop a different microbial signature.
But our interactions also change over time. Can a person's bacterial signature also change? You know, will my microbiome be the same 10 or 15 years from now?
Well, think of your body as an ecosystem, like a tropical rainforest or a swamp or a desert, no matter what you want to look at. It takes a while to establish that ecosystem, and once it establishes, it's quite stable. And our microbial ecosystem stabilizes by the time we're 2 years old. And then it remains quite stable throughout life. It has blips around adolescence and later in life. But on the whole, it's actually reasonably stable. It does vary slightly. But unless you have a dramatic shock to your body, such as dramatic surgery or lots of antibiotic use or radiotherapy or something which really pushes the ecosystem outside of its comfort limits, it won't change.
How do you even see it? I mean, anyone who's watched a crime show has seen detectives dusting for fingerprints. What do you need to be able to see a person's microbial trail?
Well, you can't see it at the scene. What we do is we take a Q-tip. A sterile Q-tip, and we swab some of the microbial signature off different surfaces in a space. And then we take the DNA from those bacterial cells that we've acquired, and we sequence those using genomic sequencing, much the same way as we do with the human genome. And that genomic sequencing tells us which bacteria are there and in what proportions. And it's those two points, the composition of the microbiome and the proportions of the composition of the microbiome, that we use to identify which person they came from.
What kind of details about a crime scene might you be able to read through bacteria?
Well, if you think about a fingerprint, you can identify whether a person was there or not there based on the presence or absence of their fingerprint on that space. Genetic evidence is similar. It tells you that the person was there or not there. But microbial evidence has a number of interesting new information twitches inside it. So I can identify, because microbes are living organisms, the time since that person interacted with that space. So, you know, we believe at the moment it's about 72 hours after a person has interacted with the space that the signature starts to decay to the point where we can't identify it. But within that 72-hour window, we can see a lot about when they were last there and potentially even who they were interacting with and maybe even what they were doing for a job or where they lived in, say, the United States. Because our microbiome is shaped by our geography and by the work we do and by who we live and talk to and work with.
So it's very different than hair or sloughed off skin.
Yeah, it's a dynamic marker shaped by our diversity, not by our genetics. And so, you know, our diverse interactions, our lifestyles shape that microbiome. And so it's that our lifestyle is almost imprinted on that microbiome. So when you leave it behind, you leave behind a lot more information about who you are and what you do than you do with just genetic signatures.
But somebody could come and vacuum away hair or sloughed off skin. Could someone come with a, you know, bottle of bleach and wipe out the microbiome?
They could, well, even your microbiome's inside you.
So, I mean, I'm sorry, the bacteria, your bacterial signature?
Yeah, they could do on surfaces, absolutely. The same as wearing a pair of gloves. Gloves could eradicate a signature from your fingerprints. But interestingly, unless a person was wearing a biohazard suit, they couldn't eradicate everything about the signature they left behind. It's very hard to eradicate all microbial life from a building or a space. And if you have a section of your skin showing, you will be sloughing bacteria into the environment. You can see this perfectly with spaceships. When we try and prep spaceships to send them to Mars, we try and sterilize them, but we've never been quite successful at doing that 100%.
Fingerprints and forensic technology have made it possible to trace crime scenes in a number of different cases. We'll add to that a new biomarker, bacterial signatures. Each person has their own, and Jack Gilbert is among those who is researching how personal microbiomes could be used to solve crimes and solve other big problems. Is your lab working currently with law enforcement to see how far you can go with bacterial evidence for crime scenes?
Yeah, we're in the nascent part of this research, but we are working with a number of law enforcement agencies in different states trying to identify if this technology could help them to develop another line of evidence, say on a corpse or even in a room. And so we're exploring how our microbial fingerprint decays after it's been deposited on different surface materials like wood and carpet and floor or clothing or even skin. And that's really helping us to pinpoint the valid usefulness of this technology.
Well, we know now that DNA evidence is not foolproof. It ages, for one thing. It can be misidentified, entering it into a computer. Is there a danger in seeing forensic technology as a slam dunk?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, forensic technology is only as good as the probability estimates that you want to apply to it. I know that sounds complicated, but everything is statistics. Two individual people can have a unique genetic signature, hence identical twins. And what we do when we look at a genetic signature is we apply a probability that it came from that person, i.e. it would be highly improbable that anybody else could have deposited that signature.
So
it's not a 100% biomarker.
But you would say, I mean, you've got somebody sitting there on the stand, you've got bacterial evidence connecting them to a crime scene. Is that enough for a conviction in your mind?
In and of itself, I would not rely on it right now. But absolutely, in the future, along with other lines of evidence, it could be incredibly valuable in telling us a lot more about who that person was that was interacting with that space, and then potentially helping us to find that person. So the person we put on the stand would be have a significantly higher probability of being the person who committed the crime.
So in the future, maybe along with a mugshot, fingerprints, we might have bacterial markers that would be associated with people who've been arrested for crimes and they would be on record.
Yeah, maybe even environmental microbial fingerprints of soil and water and environments such as homes around the country. So that, if we found a microbial fingerprint, we could say, well, this person looks like they grew up and currently live around Iowa or maybe even around Boston. We're trying to determine the particular efficiency of identifying that biogeographic signal. But it's looking very important.
So we can imagine this technology being used in law enforcement. Other positive benefits of your research on microbiomes and how they might change our daily lives?
Well, absolutely. You know, you're born essentially sterile, although even that hypothesis may be incorrect. But let's take for assumption that you're born sterile, and then you're forced into this world. And your microbiome is one of your first lines of defense against disease. And it also helps to shape your immune system and your physiological and neurological development. So our hope is that by examining how our indoor space, our homes and our cities and our cottages in the country, we may be able to generate healthier environments that can lead to the development of healthier children. So eradicating asthma and allergies, maybe even conditions like autism and Alzheimer's. So we're exploring how the microbiome shapes our health.
Really big, interesting stuff. Jack Gilbert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jack Gilbert is an environmental microbiologist and team leader at Argonne National Laboratory. You can find much more on his work with microbiomes at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, we invite you to share stories and segments with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of our archives to listen to. You can post them on social media or email them to friends. And let us know what you are hearing from your circle of friends and colleagues and sources. What are you curious about? What are you finding interesting? We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Please keep sharing them and join us again for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.